Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker back at you live, Cincinnati, Ohio, Gulf Manor Synagogue, and it's School of Jewish Studies, and we're out here tonight to take no prisoners. We're going to continue our study of 1 Kings. That's what we do on Tanakh Tuesdays. We study Melachim Aleph, 1 Kings, and we have fun. We do enjoy it over here. 1 Kings, and we are in the thick of Chapter 2, so if you have the book, by all means, join us. And if you don't have the book, sit back and relax. Now, you remember that a couple of weeks ago, before Sukkot, I think, we kind of read through the whole chapter 2 and got a feel for the Soprano-ish aspects of it. A lot of you know, Godfather talk, you know, you kill him, you know. Man's on his deathbed, David's on his deathbed, he's telling his son, you got to whack that guy, you got to whack that guy. It didn't strike me as, you know, I don't know, godly. And a lot of it still doesn't. I mean, if you felt the need to kill these people, maybe you should have done it on your own when you had the chance, when it would have been appropriate. And you bring them up in front of the trial and whatever. And I know that we've hacked that around, that maybe, you know, maybe it's not appropriate, or he didn't have political backing, or whatever, any other number of reasons as to why David didn't execute these people when he could have and when he should have. Kings act in sort of meta-judicial ways, and they kind of reserve for themselves the right to kill somebody, even if he's maybe not guilty according to biblical/rabbinic law. But if the king feels he should be worthy of death, then the king will kill him, because ancient kings in Israel had that ability. Okay, no matter how you cut it, it just seems to me that if you asked me, I would have told you that maybe it would have been better had he executed them when these people did the evil deeds that they did. And I know there's no statute of limitations, in Jewish law, because murder is murder. But it just seems to me that maybe David should have executed them when it was the ripe and the right thing and the right time to do it. And I know, as I said, we discussed it in the class, he may not have been able to do it politically. But at all events, he's now on his deathbed, and he's telling his son Shlomo, I want you to kill this one, and I want you to kill that one. And it just strikes me as the kind of stuff that you watch on the tube. It just does. At all events, welcome. And now we're going to begin in earnest. Mrs. Brolov is here. Maybe Rabbi Brolov will join us too, and others as well. We look forward to everybody's participation. You remember that last week we kind of maybe formally ended off with Pasuk Dalet, Pasuk 4, okay? And that was the Pasuk that said, this is David speaking to Shlomo, I want you to keep God's will and God's ways, that the Almighty will then continue his word, which he spoke concerning me. This is David speaking. And what did God say to David? If your children take heed to their way and they walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail you, says God, a man on the throne of Israel. That's kind of more or less where we ended off formally, although we did kind of proceed a little bit into 5. Let's review it. Let's do Pasuk Hey, verse 5 in chapter 2. The Gamata Yadata is Asher Asoli Yoav ben Tzruya. And you also remember that which Yoav ben Tzruya did to me, Asher Asoli Shnei Sarei Tzivos Yisrael, that which he did to the two captains of the host of Israel, Avner ben Ner, Amasa ben Yeser, to Avner and Amasa, for Yahargeim, he killed them, he murdered them, for Yasam Dimei Melchama B'Shalom, and he placed and he shed, is how they translate, I like that better, he shed the blood of war even though it was peacetime. We're going to unpack it a little bit. V'yitein dimei melchama b'chagor raso, he put the blood of war upon his clothing, his girdle, his sash maybe, asher b'mosnav, upon his hips or his loins, uvena'alo, and he also placed that blood, right, uvena'alo, and also upon his shoe, asher b'raglav, which is upon his feet. And I was thinking, I wrote in my note, How many shoes we're talking about? One shoe. How many feet did the guy have? Probably two. So I'm not sure exactly why David referred to a two-footed man having one shoe.
Probably the blood spilled from his knife, from his sword, into one of his shoes.
Into one of the shoes, Okay, Mrs. Brovitz makes a good point. I think it's okay. I think it's good. And that's why it says, B'chagoro so, because there's only one sash. There's only one gartle, I suppose, that he was wearing, one girdle or whatever. But yes, the blood could very well have spilled only upon one shoe, and that would make, it would make a whole lot of perfect sense. So very, very good, insightful comment. Very good. Let's just very, very briefly pick apart, and I know we did it last week. You know what what Joab did in the office, of course, his nephew, what he did to these two captains of the host. And we said, or maybe if we didn't, we'll say it now, that Avner was the captain of the host, and Amasa was the captain of the host to Absalom. It says over here in our footnotes in English. And David wanted to appoint Amasa as captain of the army to replace Joab when Joab would eventually be removed. And now, sadly, even Amasa is gone. Amasa himself is dead because of Joab. So David is laying it out. He says, I know that this guy is my nephew, but we're going to have to take care of him. And he spilled blood during peacetime, and we may have read the Malbim. Do you remember if we did, Mrs. Brill? I'm not sure if we did. If we did not, we'll just do a quick read right now. Originally, Avner and Amasa opposed David. This is going to be from the Malbim in the Judaica Press. Avner was aligned with Ish-bosheth. Amasa hooked up with Absalom. Under those circumstances, Yoav had an opportunity to kill them in war, which would have been entirely justified because they were with David's enemies. Instead, he waited to kill them after they had made peace with David. That you can't do. The blood which should have been shed in war was then shed in peace. This arrogant act proved most embarrassing to David by undermining the trustworthiness of his kingdom and the reliability of David's treaties and promises. Joab, as captain of the host, was considered David's spokesman. By killing them in peace, it appeared as though David reneged on his commitments. That's how it looked. It looked as if David was telling his man Joab, I want you to kill this guy, kill that guy. The furthest thing from David's mind to kill those people. And if you're not going to take the opportunity to kill them in battle, certainly with the Absalom thing, there was certainly a battle. I don't recall any Ish-bosheth battle. But with Absalom, there was a pitched battle in the field, and if you're not going to kill somebody there, then that's it. No, he waits until the end.
When was the whole killing field? Was that still under Shaul with Abner leading Shaul's troops or whatever, and Yoav had David's troops, and that's when Yoav, his brother, was killed, and that's why he killed Abner? Was that with Shaul, or was that with Ish-bosheth?
I think Shaul was gone, and this happened at the very beginning of Shmuel Beis. Shaul had already, I think, passed away. I don't think that it involved Shaul's...
It was like... Let's sport and have the
sporting thing going on, right?
Yeah, and they started killing each other.
That's right. It wasn't so much a battle royale in the fields as like actual warfare, but rather it was a bunch of guys horsing around.
And they started and got really out of hand.
They got rowdy and out of hand, right? And then, because I thought Ish-bosheth wasn't he lame?
Right.
Wasn't he not well on his leg?
And Devin took care of him.
Yeah. Right, so I don't,
But I can't remember, but there was a reason that they were fighting, and I can't remember who Abner was serving at that time.
Mm-hmm. Could be he was on the other team, and
right.
He started to And he started to...
I know he was on the other team, but the question is, why
was it taking place? I think that they all just kind of, all these men gathered around, if I'm not mistaken, they gathered around and chatted with each other and then started to challenge each other. And then, as you said a moment ago, started to horse around a little bit. And before you knew it, swords were drawn and blood was shed. So at all events, Abner was indeed with Ishbosheth, and if he was worthy of being killed, it should have been done then. It should not have waited. Furthermore, he writes, were he to best them in a fair and equal duel, then he would deserve commendation. He would then have proven to be a more experienced warrior than they. Instead, he killed them by trickery and deception, befitting a coward. And Rashi says, since they were at peace with him at the time of his sly attack, they were not on guard against him. Right? And he put the blood of war upon his girdle that was about his loins, says the pasuk, and the footnote here says, David goes on to detail the treachery committed by Yoav. In the case of Amasa, Yoav approached and greeted him in a most cordial and friendly manner. And Rashi lays it out. He had girded his loins, he had girded his sword attached to his loins, not in the customary manner of those girding swords, and he went out to meet Amasa. Instead of arranging the opening of the sheath upward to contain the sword, he turned the opening downward, so it should easily fall out of that sheath to the ground. As the pasuk says in 2 Shmuel, this is chapter 20, verse 8, he went out towards Amasa, and it, the sword, fell out. And as he approached Amasa, Yoav bent forward slightly, just enough for the smoothly sharpened sword to slide innocently to the ground. As soon as it fell, he nonchalantly retrieved it and held it ready in his hand. And we go to the next page. Amasa presumed he retrieved it solely to pick it up from the ground, and he was not alert to guard himself against an attack from the sword, which was in Yoav's hand. This is Rashi. And then Radak, to complete the deception, Yoav held the sword in his left hand and gripped Amasa's beard with his right hand in order to kiss him. At that point, Amasa was an easy victim to Yoav's gleaming blade. Man, that has got to be just the craziest moment. You're meeting a man you know, you consider to be a colleague, a friend, an associate, and he's got a sword. And before you know it, one minute he's giving you a kiss, the next minute he's plunging the sword into you. All right. And the court, Mrs. Brillo's shot might even be as good, if not better, than what we're reading over here with the Radak. And in his shoe, they put in the in the plural, though I think that the Hebrew is pretty clear, it's in the singular. Although the truth is that if you had to really darshan it, you could say with a na'alav, and there's no yud over there, that would make you read it with a na'alav, but it says with a na'alav, and even though it's missing a yud, if you really had to, maybe you could read it with a na'alav, if you really wanted to drush it out. But still, with it missing that yud, you think that it's only one singular shoe, with a na'al shalom, and then one on his one shoe. Okay, they translated in his shoes, on his feet. Some render this as a reference to the previous incident. This is the Radak. As Yoav bent down to tie his shoes, which he was wearing on his feet, his sword fell out. Okay, good. So that was last week as well. We did a little bit of that last week, Pasuk Hey. And now we continue on to Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Now this is David continuing to speak to Shlomo, V'asisa kechochmasecha, you will do according to your wisdom. You must act according to your wisdom, v'lo toreit seivaso b'shalom sha'ol, and do not bring his seiva, his hoary head. Maybe we could translate that, seiva panim yafos. Don't we darshan that word? You're supposed to, rabbis say, you're supposed to greet everybody, but seiva panim yafos, with a warm countenance and so on. But over here, they're going to translate, don't bring down, v'lo toreid, do not cause to come down, don't bring down, save us so, maybe his gray hairs, b'shalom, in peace, sha'ol. And the word sha'ol is used extensively throughout the Tanakh. It stands for the grave, the netherworld. Yaakov uses that term also. You're going to bring down my gray hairs, sha'ola, to the grave. Now he's talking to the boys. He wants to send them down to Yosef to get some food and so on. And they're trying to work it out. And he says, if you're going to bring back Binyamin, we're going to have a problem, because you're going to bring down my gray hairs, sha'ola, to the grave. So the word sha'ol means grave in ancient, in the Hebrew Bible. And curious, I'd like to maybe do a little talk on that one day, the usage of the word sha'ol. What was understood by that?
I have my answer.
Go ahead.
After Saul's death, Abner was supporting Ishbosheth. And so there was, Abner brings Ishbosheth to the town of Machanaim and gets support for him. In a moment of apparent peace between the two camps,
mm-hmm.
Abner meets David's general Yoav at the pool of Givon,
mm-hmm.
and Abner proposes that their young warriors engage in hand-to-hand combat, 12 against 12.
Right.
The fighting turns serious, with Yoav's men gaining the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yoav's fleet-footed brother Asael chases Abner, who does not want to engage him, for fear of creating bad blood with Yoav and David. When Asael refuses to give up the chase, Abner finally turns and slays him with a spear.
Right.
So that was when he was supporting Ishbosheth.
Thank you, and thank you for giving us the background on that. They all met at that spring.
Mm-hmm.
You can almost picture it. Initially it's all innocent. Sorry?
What would we do without the internet?
I can't imagine. Everything is, hunky-dory. Guys are meeting each other. They're talking to each other. And before you know it, a fight's breaking out, and people running after each other, and people are dying. Thank you very much. Okay, so don't let his gray hairs go down, bishalom, in peace, sha'ol, to the grave. And there's a lot here that we have to unpack. So let's get right to it. Let's see the Rashi. Okay. It says, Rashi, v'lo tereit seivaso b'shalom sha'ol. Don't bring down his gray hairs in peace to the grave. Says Rashi, Al tinichehu lamus misas atzma. Don't allow him to die a death, a regular, normal, personal expiration kind of death. V'lipol b'gehinam. And then as a result of that kind of death, he'll fall into hell, he'll fall into Gehenna. Not good. And let's just see the Rashi, let's just see the footnote, which is going to incorporate the Rashi.
And the Yakut Shimoni.
Thank you. Yoav was David's nephew, the son of David's sister. So you realize, anybody who's got a nephew or a niece knows, this kid is very much part of the family. Therefore, although their relationship was most unfriendly, David still had Yoav's ultimate welfare in mind. And how do you have his ultimate welfare in mind? You kill him. Okay, you kill him because the alternative is going to be much worse. What am I talking about? He instructed Solomon, don't let him die a natural death. And that's Rashi's language. Now we're going to fill it in. Because letting him die a natural death will minimize his world to stay with me. That would minimize his worldly punishment. Now back to Rashi, and then that would cause him to fall into purgatory. That's not really a Jewish term, but okay. For torturous purification. That's where my understanding is. A little I understand about the next world. Just virtually all the neshamas have done something wrong, and they've got to go get cleansed. And that's an 11-month process, whatever. And then after that, hopefully the neshama is cleaned up, and then worthy of hanging out with the tzaddikim in Olam Haba in Gan Eden.
So the thing is, if he's guilty of murder,
yeah,
which he was, being murdered.
He was on the run from a guy who might have killed him. Isn't that fair to say?
When he killed Avner and Asael.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Avner killing Asael. He was being
right.
He was being approached maybe for death. But Yoav killing Avner, that ain't right. So we gotta now take care of Yoav.
So the only way to get kapara in this world is to be killed.
Right. So thank you. So it sounds really horrendous. Let's all be honest. This is a rabbinic spin that makes a lot of sense. We all have to understand that if you're coming at it from this approach, from the rabbinic idea that explaining biblical Judaism, which doesn't really talk very much about the souls and what happens and life after this, that doesn't even get into that. It just doesn't. But the rabbis often do. And now that you know that we have another, clearly there's another life up there, and there's punishment and reward, and the rabbis flesh out the idea, as Mrs. Berloff just said so nicely, that we either get punished in this world or in the next. This is a very, very, kind of worked over idea. It's not the first time we've seen this. So if you get punished in this world, hopefully there's a little bit less to deal with in the next world. And indeed, that's exactly why the rabbis say there are death penalty punishments given out by the Torah in this world. People do bad things, crazy things. So you get skila, you get treifa, you get hereg, you get chenek, the four major capital execution styles of ancient Jewish life in Israel. And a person got those things in order to hopefully get cleansed in this world, and then he can approach God in the next and say, I just got punished. How much more should I get punished? I just got my throat, got molten lead down my throat. I mean, you got anything worse than that? I mean, how much more do I have to go through? So hopefully, skila, whatever that was, getting tossed off a ledge and getting stoned, I mean, it had to be horrible. So if you underwent those kinds of punishments, then hopefully that was some sort of kapara. And that is why God gave it to us to do that. God gave us those executions so that the individual who did something bad can hopefully be cleansed a little bit into the next world and not have to go through so much. Get better to take care of it here. It's actually easier here on earth than up there is the general consensus. And so that's exactly what's going on over here. Let's not let Yoav die a natural death. Let's execute him here. He'll have less to deal with up with God in the next world, Mrs. Berloff.
The other thing is that David HaMelech, being the kind of person he is and having these relationships, we see he didn't want Avshalom was rebelling against him. He doesn't want Avshalom hurt.
True.
It's his son.
Right.
This is his nephew and his general who's taking care of him. So he's got that conflict feeling where on one hand he wants him killed, and on the other hand he doesn't want him killed. So he's postponing it and telling his son, mm-hmm, take care of it for me. I couldn't bring myself to do it.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. And I just want to add on that if I can. Thank you. The man who gave us the Book of Psalms, which is, arguably among the most uplifting and emotional and personal. And Mrs. Broth has the exclusive of making sure that people here in Cincinnati, the ladies, finish it every Monday night. I myself have done a little bit every so often to help out my spouse. It is so godly. The man who gave us the Book of Psalms knows what's going on with the neshamas, with the souls, and if he's the one who's giving Solomon this directive, it really has to be for the betterment of his nephew. It can't be for his worseness. It can't be that he's just being simply vindictive, because hopefully it was not like that.
He had plenty of time for that.
Sure he did, right, and he never actually acted on it. And now, as you said, he couldn't bring himself to do it. It was his nephew. Who can possibly touch a person's nephew? It's just
Who's defending him?
Who's defending him?
Yeah, his nephew, who has been defending him.
Who's been the captain of his host, going to battle on his behalf, fighting his battles. Absolutely. And the only reason why David would ever say such a thing to his son Shlomo would only be for the benefit of Yoav. Because there's no way that David, loving his
nephew,
would do anything against the benefit of his own nephew. So we are perforce obligated to come on to this understanding that this has to be done here, right now, for the betterment of his neshama. And Yoav will be the first one up in Shemayim to say, thank you, Uncle David. You helped me out. I got killed on earth, and it mamish really took off a lot of the punishment up here in the world to come in the next world. So I'm grooving to that idea. I like it more and more the more I think about it, and I'm accepting it 100%. Rashi and Yalkut Shimoni, Yeshikayach, thank you, Mrs. Roller, for fleshing it out too. And therefore, that's pshat, that seems to be pasha pshat. Do not bring down his gray hairs, b'shalom, in peace, to the grave. Do what you got to do to make sure you whack him here on earth, and then do not let him expire a natural death. Verse 7, Pasuk Zion. Vilivnei Barzilai Hagiladi. And the children, or in reference to, better way to do it, and in reference to the children of Barzillai the Gileadite, David says to his son, Taseh Chesed, do kindness. V'hayu, they should be, so that they will be, Ba'ochlei Shulchanecha, among those who eat at your table. Why? What is Barzillai? What did he do? Kichein karvu elai bevarachim ipnei Avshalom achicha. Kichein karvu elai, because in such a way, because this is what they did. They came close to me. They befriended me. They were nice to me. They became krovim. Kichein karvu elai. In so doing, in such a similar way, the way that you're going to invite them into your home and into your royal table, they were doing the same thing to me, bevarchi, in my fleeing, in my running away, b'pnei Avshalom achicha, from before Avshalom, your brother. As I was running away, I was being helped by Barzillai and his extended people. So let's take a look at that, if there's any Rashi or any footnote. There is actually a little something over here. Let me just see. Not so much a Rashi, but he's going to quote down a Malbim. So let's go see it. When I fled from Avshalom, your brother, and the Jacob is going to quote the Malbim. Here it is. Barzillai the Gileadite proved himself to be a true friend. He befriended me at a time when there was little hope, if any, of ever being repaid. Things were not looking good. Truth be told, if we all remember what was happening back then, David HaMelech was running for his life from his son. His son was gaining the popular vote, and David was on the run, and if you had to be a betting man, if you had to bet on anybody, the typical Vegas odds would have been on Avshalom. He's popular. People do like him. He was talking to people at the courts, vote for me, and they did. I'm handsome, I'm good-looking, I'm tall, I got everything going for me, and he did. And there's David on the run. So if you were a betting man, the Vegas odds would have been very much against David. And what did Barzillai do? He helped out David. Says the Malbim here, my very kingdom was in danger when I fled from Absalom, your brother. And yet still in all, Barzillai, it was a stand-up guy, and he helped me and befriended me, housed me, fed me, and so on and so forth, and that is what a friend does. So be nice to him, do chesed to him, and let them, that is to say, his family, his children, his extended people, let them eat at your table. Okay? Now we're going to go into yet another another directive to whack somebody else. Now I realize now that we've given it the proper rabbinic spin, it's probably wrong to keep on thinking about these things in terms of the Sopranos, who only whack people because they're invading his space, taking over my business, they're doing bad things, they just insulted my wife. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you read about or watch on TV. But over here, David is saying, listen, these people did not do right. And they're going to have to answer to God. And it won't be pleasant. Let me take care of him here on earth. When you approach it from that angle, David is actually being, in his way, he is thinking very long term. The only problem is, and lahavdil bein tuma latahara, alfei alafim and alafos. Lahavdil bein tuma latahara, I don't even know how I'm going to say this. But I'm going to say it because, and I know that if Rabbi Brulov were here, he'd smile and he would jump all over it and he would add a lot. Mrs. Brulov is also welcome to do so. When the Catholic Church, sorry, but hear me out, because I'm going to try to make a point that I think might be on point. When the extricable Catholic Church in the Middle Ages gave Jewish people the choice, now it wasn't the church per se, it wasn't coming from Rome, it didn't believe in killing Jews. There's a whole Torah about that David Berger said in Boston at Boston College back in the day, and I was there and I heard it. I was up there for a week scouting out the city, and he gave a speech at a Jesuit school. And he was explaining various things as to, you know, why the church did what it did. I'll get back to that in a second. I don't want to lose the stream of thought at the moment. There were always some undermention in the Catholic Church who would say to the Jewish people, convert or die. So the Jews would say, we're going to die. Nobody's going to convert. And the church would say, well, you know, you better convert, because if you convert, it'll save your soul forever and ever. And that's why we're giving you this choice. So you got to take us up on this option. And we recommend the conversion thing because the debt's going to be painful. And then you're still going to have to pay for it for eternity. So you might as well convert right now. It'll be for the betterment of your soul. Does that sound a little bit familiar? Kind of. Mrs. Brulov is laughing. Sounds like the same argument. De la havdil, ben tuma la tahara. Differentiate between holiness and impurity. David's going, I want you to get killed now, so it'll be better for your soul. Mrs. Brulov, why don't you shed some light on this for me?
It's the opposite. Because the church was saying, don't get killed and save your soul.
Don't get killed.
To save
and therefore convert rather and save your soul.
Save your soul and your life.
And your life. If you convert, you'll live here and you'll live in the next world, is what they said.
Right.
Right.
Whereas he's saying kill him now.
Kill him
so
now.
So
that he'll live in the next world. Right. And there is a difference there. Right. And then when the church actually did wind up, when the individuals representing the church actually did wind up killing Jews, they probably never came around and said, and this is going to be for the betterment of your neshama.
Because it wasn't, because
right.
because at that point they hadn't accepted.
Exactly. So
that was that killing them was not to save their soul.
Right. It was just to
kill them.
Kill them because they hadn't taken up the proper choice.
At which point they went straight to Shemayim for Kiddush Hashem.
That's right. Going against every Catholic, you know, theology going, they wound up going to heaven because they died on Kiddush Hashem. That really must have stunned them. When the church guys got up there, it didn't really work out for them the way they thought. Funny thing. I just want to, I owe you a little explanation. It's just 2 minutes or so. Professor David Berger was explaining that the Roman Catholic Church in the, probably from Augustine and on, Augustine said, no, don't kill Jewish people. We don't believe in that. That's craziness. We don't kill people. These are people who gave us our Savior, gave us the apostles, gave us the Bible, gave us so much. You don't, I mean, Jews were around for like 1,000 years before we came. What are you talking about? Don't kill Jews. But we can economically aggravate them to death. I mean, not to death, but we can economically hurt them. So let's put them down economically, and if we do that, and if they're financially stressed, then that's going to show that they're in the wrong and we are in the right. And so you'll find that there are almost no papal bulls coming out of any pope ever saying things like, I hereby command that we send people to kill Jews. The popes never said that. They said you should kill heretics within the church. Go out and kill the Muslims in the holy wars. Stay with me on that one. Go off and and cleanse the church internally from the heresies. But they never came out and said that we believe as an institution that we have to kill Jewish people. That they never said. So then how do you explain hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of murders of Jews during the Middle Ages? And the answer he gave is, as I said a moment ago, those underlings, those untermenschen within the church, this Dominican priest, that Meshuggah, Peter the Hermit maybe, this bishop, that guy, they would take it upon themselves to rile up a crowd, and the crowd would go crazy, and the crowd would kill Jews. And even during the Crusades, it's more or less how it was. The Pope would say, go off and get the Holy Land back from the Muslims. He never said, and along the way, if you see a Jew, kill that Jew. They never said that. That was like a bunch of low, scummy guys, part of the church, who would say, let's go kill Jews along the way. But that was never coming from the Bishop of Rome. And for whatever it's worth, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to throw it out there for you, because what can I say? I happen to know that. So as long as we're talking about this world, the next world, and all that, I thought maybe it might be relevant to you. So that's David Berger, and he said all that in the Jesuit college known as Boston College up in Boston. It was a great, great speech. Okay, so be nice to Barzillai the Giladi. Good. He was good to me. You be good to him. Pasuk Ches, verse 8. We are flying through the text over here. V'hine, and behold, Imacha, with you, Shimi ben Gera, ben Hayamini. You got this guy named Shimi ben Gera. He's from Binyamin. He's a Benjaminite. Mibachurim. Excuse me, comes from the town of Bachurim. Vahu Kilalani Klala Nimretzet. And he cursed me. A Nimretzet curse. What is Nimretzet? We'll get to that in a second. Machlokes Rashi and the Radak is to how to understand that word. But he really cursed me a curse. B'yom lechti Machanayim, when I was leaving Machanayim, b'yarad lekrasi hayardein, he came down towards me at the Jordan River, and he let loose. V'yashav lo b'Hashem, I swore to him by God, Lamor, saying, Im amitcha becharev, I will not kill you by the sword. Now, all right, let me just unpack this a little bit better. he cursed me on the day when I went to Machanayim. And then when sometime later, I suppose his conscience really smote him and he felt bad,
I think that
he then met me at the Jordan River.
I think that was after Avshalom was defeated.
Right.
And so he was scared because David's in control again.
Right. Mrs. Brewer reminds me, thank you, that when David's forces defeated Avshalom's forces, and that probably stunned everybody who was paying attention, they didn't expect that to happen. Nobody really did. And David is now the king again. Guess what? He's now the Melech, and now he's going back to reclaim the throne in Jerusalem. And Shimi ben Gera says to himself, you know, if I don't get clear, if I don't clear things up with King David, I am definitely going to be in a bad way. Because he's now the king again. He could just send guys to get me and they'll kill me. So he goes down to meet David. If you remember this, he goes down to meet David at the Jordan River and he says, oh, please forgive me. And it gives like a Jackie Mason kind of almost routine. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what I was doing. And David says, okay, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to kill you. And he doesn't. And he leaves him alone. And Shimei goes about his business. And David goes back to the throne in Jerusalem. So that's how we unpack it. But now he's telling Solomon, his son, David is, and he says, you know, I want you to, you're going to have to take care of Shimei ben Gera, and it's going to have to be the same exact kind of theory. I don't want his neshama to have to suffer in the next world because of me. What else can you say? So let's go ahead and unpack it, see what the Rishonim say about this. If anything, they're going to talk about a klala nimretzet. Okay? The Radak says, V'hine imecha, behold, he is with you. What does that mean, he's with you? He's in a different tribe, right? I mean, not that far away, perhaps, but still in all, not exactly, you know, hanging out as your next-door neighbor. Where is Binyamin? According to my trusty little map over here, I always thought that Binyamin, Yehuda and Binyamin were close by to each other, and wasn't Yerushalayim and the area kind of in a general vicinity. At all events, Radak says as follows, V'hine imecha, and behold, he is with you. Kloman is to say, Afal pi shehu mishevet Binyamin, even though he is from the tribe of Benjamin, imecha, he's with you. U'v'rishutcha, who? And he is in your rishus, he's in your jurisdiction. La'avio lidei misa, to bring him to death. O Pirush, or perhaps the explanation is, V'hine imecha b'Yerushalayim, behold, he is with you here in Jerusalem. Kedei shetuchal lemtzolo ilah, the siba lahamito, so that you should be able to find, and the word ilah means a cause or a pretext. You see that word again and again coming up over here. The Radak and Rashi will use that word a lot because that's what we're talking about. David is telling Solomon, I want you to find some sort of ilah, some sort of cause, some sort of grounds. Come up with some kind of pretext to have this guy killed. And he's here in Yerushalayim, and therefore he's close by to you, such that you should be able to find some sort of cause and thereby put him to death. And in the drush, there's a medrash, says the Radak, uvidrash ki rabo haya. Shimi ben Gera was Solomon's Rebbe. Shimi ben Gera was teaching Shlomo HaMelech Torah. And he would teach him the law. And that's the pshat when it says, behold, he is with you. There's a reason why. You're 12 years old and you have a Rebbe. His name is Shimi ben Gera and he's always with you. That's why it says, Behold, Shimei is with you because he's your Rebbe and he is teaching you Torah. Okay? Fine. So now, what is the word nimretzet mean? And the Radak says that the word klala nimretzet is a klala chazaka, a strong curse. He let me have it with the real goods. Shamalo ish hadamim. Remember what he said about me. He called me a man of blood. Ish habiliyaal. Now the word biliyaal, man, that's fighting words. I mean, we use that term for Eli's sons. We use that term maybe even for Navo, Abigail's husband, maybe not. But the idea is that the word biliyaal, oh, Yiftach, he hung out with back in the book of Shoftim. Yiftach was described, well, his men were anshei biliyaal. They were like lowlives. They were empty. They were not Torah-oriented people. And that's the term, to be an ish biliyaal means, I guess, with biliol, with no yoke of heaven upon you. And that's exactly how, you know, Yiftach's guys were and Eli's children, although some say that they were great themselves and Eli was great, they acted in a very, very bad manner. And so that's the phrase that's used. I can't get around it. Whenever you see the term biliyaal, you know it's exceptionally negative. So over here, that's what Shimei was saying to David. You are a murderer. You're a man of blood. You're an ish biliyaal. You're like a lowlife scoundrel. Okay? And what does Rashi say is a klala nimretzet? That means for Rashi, mifureshet, like explicit. Making clear. I'm making this curse very, very clear cut. It's a clear cut language kind of a curse. And that, in a nutshell, is the difference between the Rishonim and the how to understand the word nimretzet. Okay? Let's go back now to, let me just see. Let's go see some of those footnotes on 8, on page 19. And behold, with you is Shimei the son of Gera. David sought to prevent a repetition of his own bitter and disappointing experiences with Shimei. Since Shimei taught Shlomo Torah, see the Gemara in Bracha 17a, and Shimei was his close friend and advisor, and he was not among the followers of Adoniyahu, David feared that Shlomo would completely confide in him. He therefore used this opportunity to warn Shlomo of his suspicions of betrayal. So says the Abarbanel. Don't get too close to this man, even though he's your close friend and advisor. Don't confide in him. See the word Nimretzet, who cursed me with a grievous curse. The word Nimretzet is rendered by most commentaries as strong or severe, a grievous curse. In truth, so says the Radak, and he quotes the Rabag and the Metzuda. Others maintain Nimretzet means clear and unquestionable. That's the Rashi approach, as you see in Tupsukim and Iyuv. What will bring clarity to you? How clear are the correct words? And the same as Nimletzu, the derivation of the word Melitza, an interpretation or clarification with the letter Lamed replacing the letter Resh. Okay? Nimletzu, could have been Nimritzu, with Lamed replacing Resh, a clear and unquestionable curse. And he came down to meet me at the Jordan. That's what Shimei ben Gera did in an effort to save his life. Says the Judaic Assyrians, besides the first and more obvious act of disloyalty, David continues, Shimei followed with another and more humiliating display of arrogance. He came down to meet me as I crossed the Jordan to compel me to forgive him for his original wickedness. Amongst other things, he said that in the matter of Avshalom, all Israel sinned against me, and he more so than others. If I would forgive him, all Israel would feel confident to ask forgiveness. Otherwise, he threatened me, I would lose the loyalty of all Israel. Quoting the Abarbanel. Interesting stuff. All his theory was, listen, King David, everybody sinned against you. Okay, so I was the worst. I came after you and I really unleashed hell on you. I shouldn't have done that. But remember, everybody, you know, was rooting against you. And please forgive me, and then everybody else can also approach you for forgiveness. That will encourage them to do so. Otherwise, you're going to lose the loyalty of all Israel. And that's what Shimei said to David. Okay?
Okay, so here's where Binyamin is. He left it off the map.
Thank you. Let's see what we have over here. Binyamin is just underneath Ephraim.
Right.
Just on top of Judah.
I thought it was very close.
Mm-hmm, yes.
But
sandwiched in between Ephraim and Judah.
They just left it off the map. That's the only Shevet that's missing.
Right.
From the map. So they just forgot it. Maybe because of...
Right. Excellent. It's a great map. That is a very useful map. Where do I get that? Just type in Tribe of Benjamin? Great stuff.
I said, where in Israel? What area of Israel did Benjamin occupy?
Small little bit above Yehuda, and it seems that,
they
yes.
They were pretty much whacked out, too.
Yeah. Above Bethlehem, Adonai Yerushalayim, that's where Binyamin, that's where the tribe of Binyamin had, had a little bit of land over there. Manasseh had an enormous amount of land, it seems, and Ephraim also a chunk, but Judah very, very large. Judah very, very large.
With Shimon in the middle.
And Shimon, I thought, was scattered amongst Klal Yisrael.
Well, I think they're scattered among Yehuda.
Oh, yeah, I see them over there. Shimon is right in the middle of Yehuda, right. I thought Dan was all the way up north.
Yeah.
They got Asher all the way up north. Naphtali also all the way up north. And I thought Dan was all the way up north. What do I know? Looks like Dan is up against the Plishtim on the coast. Fascinating map.
This one has Dan up here and Asher and Naphtali down there.
So let me just see. Wow, you know what? It looks like we've got machlokes between the cartographers. Mrs. Brill was looking at a map that purports to be a map of ancient Israel divided up among the tribes. It does not, repeat, it does not really kind of comport with the one over here.
I just had it done. See, it's over there.
The Asher is up there. Here's Zevulun. They want Naphtali up against Asher. It seems that Zevulun over here is in between. Yisachar is up there, kind of. Menashe, okay. So there is a little bit of and then Dan. And suddenly Dan is way up high. I mean, he's like in Aram Naharaim. I mean, he's all the way up there.
Well, he's up, on here too. It says Dan.
Right? Oh, there's Dan. So there's the city of Dan, and there's the tribe of Dan. And yet we don't seem to see that over here in this particular Judaica Press map. Right, and
Dan is way up here.
Right, but according to your map, Dan is supposed to be over here on the coast with alongside the Plishtim, and it doesn't seem to be.
He's down on the way. Coast.
Yeah, Dan. Dan.
Oh. Yeah, because we hold he's all the way up north.
Right, there's a pasuk that even says as much. Here in Lech Lecha, right, that he Avram pursued and told Dan. Was it known as Dan back then? That's a good question. That's what everybody tumbles.
Was
it going to be called Dan later on?
This is according to the book of Yehoshua, and I don't know where they got that from Yehoshua. They said it was down there.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have 5 more minutes. Okay. What does the word b'charev over here with a sword? What's up with that? I want you to take care of him. I'm sorry, David, and I am telling Shlomo Melech, David said, don't worry, by God himself, I won't kill you. Imamitcha b'charev. I will not put you to death with the sword. So let's see the footnote over there.
Because that would have been what he had with him at the time.
I mean, that was probably what just about everybody had back in the day. Yoav had that. Everybody had a sword. It was, you know, concealed carry, I think.
Especially with Yoav.
Yeah, especially with Yoav. He was definitely concealed carrying. Oh, my goodness. With the sword. This did not imply, this is the Judaica Press, this did not imply that David was free to slay Shimei by other means. You know, oh, I'm not going to kill you by sword. I'll kill you some other way. It doesn't mean that. It would indeed be ludicrous for David to swear that he wouldn't put Shimei to death by the sword, yet reserve other methods of executing him. Yeah, don't worry, I'm not going to kill you by sword. I'll kill you some other way in a couple minutes. It's not how David was talking. That would have been, as they say, outlandish. What would have meant? The truth of the matter is that the king was vested with the power to execute anyone who rebels against him, as has been discussed in Joshua chapter 1, verse 18, where Joshua's men said, oh, master, you have nothing to worry about. We've got your back. If anybody rebels against you, we will put him to death. That's Joshua chapter 1, verse 18. Unlike the court, however, he, meaning David, was only permitted to execute rebels with the sword. See the Rambam, Hilchos Malachim, the Laws of Kings, chapter 3, verse 8, Halacha 8, from the Tosefta and Sanhedrin, chapter 9, Halacha 3, and see Yerushalmi Sanhedrin, chapter 1, Halacha 1. I'm sorry, chapter 7, Halacha 1. Thus David swore to Shimei that he would not put him to death with the sword, as a rebel against the king should be dispatched. So you're going to get to live. I'm not going to kill you with the sword, which is the only way I, as the king, can personally put you to death if you are considered a morid b'malchus, a rebel against me. So then how come he did not kill Uriah the Hittite with the sword? Oh, this is my question. Anybody? I mean, I know we're revisiting our long-lost stuff, and it took us a long time to get through that material. But if, according to those who felt that David considered Uriah Hitti a morid b'malchus, a rebel, for not listening to his orders to go back to his wife, and instead Uriah preferred to sleep in the court or whatever, so then how come David didn't execute him right there and then with the sword? Why all the machinations with the notes and with the let him get killed in the war?
He didn't want to look like he was responsible.
He didn't want to look like he was responsible.
And he didn't, and I guess he felt it would be more honorable for Uriah. Uriah was one of his top generals. It would be more honorable for him to die in battle than the king whacking.
So even though it seems to us the halacha has been crystallized that a king is only allowed to execute rebels with the sword, and David did not do that. He had a rebel whom he did not kill with a sword. Still in all, that's why he did what he did. It would have been embarrassing and so on. I didn't want to get involved in that. I hear. All right?
And he was told he was wrong.
Right. Absolutely right. Okay. Now, according to the Zohar, they say over here this phrase, b'charev, with the sword, it's connected to an earlier part of the pasuk. I swore with the sword. Okay, Vashava lo Bashem, I swore with the sword. Now, what does that mean? I swore. Oh, I see what he's saying. I see what he's saying. The phrase with the sword doesn't mean I promise you I'm not going to kill you with a sword. It means that I took a vow. I took an oath with the sword. And here they flesh it out, according to the Zohar. David's sword was engraved with the name of God. When he wished to swear, he would draw his sword and swear by it. Alternatively, he swore not to slay Shimei by the sword, because Shimei had humiliated him with words. Indeed, Benayahu, the son of Yehoyada, slew Shimei by uttering the name of Hashem. So he swore not to slay Shimei by the sword, because Shimei humiliated him with words. Therefore, David had him killed with words as well, and not with the sword. That is a most interesting, creative approach to interpretation. And very much Mida Keneged Mida indeed. Absolutely, yes. That's right. Okay, good. It's 8:30. We're right on the button. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Hopefully you enjoyed. We did another few psukim in Chapter 2 of 1 Kings. Please come on back next week as we'll continue our study on Tanakh Tuesday nights. With sheer enjoyment, coming to you straight from Gulf Manor Synagogue and a School of Jewish Studies in Cincinnati, Ohio. Next week again, 7:30 on Tuesday night, we'll continue again with the material here, second chapter of 1 Kings. Signing off, it's Shmuel Plotz, wishing everybody a very, very good week and a good Shabbos, and all the best. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.